We're in the Library of the Molecular and Cell Biology Department at the University of California, Berkeley, visiting with Dan Feldman, who's actually a professor of molecular and cell biology here, although I think of you as a neuroscientist, fellow member of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, based at UC San Diego, which is where you used to be before here. And you're also associated with the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute here as well, right? I want you to explain some of the basics of what you do, but let me just context that first of all by saying we just got back from a meeting in Arizona at ASU, and it was an Education Innovation Summit. A lot of people talking about the sorts of things we've been talking about that you see on the cover of Time magazine. Should schools bribe kids? Do we need better teachers? So on and so forth. It's the subject of the meeting that we did about a month ago to discuss the possibility of creating an incentive-based innovations in education, an education X prize possibly. At the Arizona meeting, one of the comments that was made to me afterwards was that although it was great, lots of energy and so on, there was an element missing, which was neuroscience. There were no neuroscientists there. And if I look at your website, your lab page here, which is titled, apart from Feldman Lab, Plasticity and Processing in the Somatosensory Cortex, it says, we're a neuroscience research lab that studies the function and development of the cortex, cerebral cortex. Our goals are to understand how the cortex processes sensory information, stores information during learning, and is shaped by sensory experience during development, which all sounds to me like education. But let me just finish this off. Work is critical for understanding normal brain function, developing new insights and new therapeutic strategies for neurological disorders such as mental retardation, learning disability, autism, Alzheimer's, and epilepsy. We focus both on cellular physiology and on systems level sensory representation and sensory processing. You work with rodents, mm-hmm. And lab is part of also a member of the TDLC, as I just said, Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, whose goal is to understand how timing affects learning on the neurobiological cognitive levels and to use this information to improve education. Slightly long introduction, but that sort of situates things. What I'd like you to do now is to tell me how you get from lab work with rodents and topics like spike timing dependent plasticity to the cover I just showed you of Time magazine and other things.
Well, the seat of learning in the body is the brain. Yeah. And to understand how the brain performs learning and also the constraints that it puts on learning, both natural constraints and also constraints that may arise in certain brain conditions, you need to understand how the brain works and how it actually performs learning for the organism. We do study this in rodents, and this is because there are many levels of investigation that can only uniquely be done in animal models of learning and can't really be done in humans, nor would we want them to be done in humans. The rodent brain is very similar at the genetic and cellular and circuit level to the human brain, and if you find forms of learning that are in common between rodents and humans, of which there are many, many basic forms of learning in common, we take the hypothesis, like many neurobiologists, that the mechanisms for that learning in the rodent brain will tell us a lot about how the human brain does that job. So we are basic neurobiologists who work from the cellular to the circuit level in the rodent brain in order to understand how mammalian brains in general, including human brains, learn important things.
Okay, so what are the fundamental things that somebody sitting at home or somebody in another discipline, another scientific discipline, not a neuroscientist, what are the basics that they need to know about the kind of territory that we're covering here?
Well, the first thing to know...
The information processing part of it.
The first thing to know is that there are many different forms of learning. And these can be recognized in people and in lower animals. Some of these forms of learning are quite high level and cognitive and tend to be what we think of when we think colloquially about learning. You think about learning a fact or a figure, remembering that fact or some element of your biographical life later on. These things there are actually correlates that occur in rodents, but they're much more difficult to study outside of humans. There are simpler forms of learning which turn out to be very important for human learning and human development, which seem to occur very similarly or identically in rodents versus humans. And one example of this is what we call sensory perceptual learning. So it turns out that when you learn to see the world or feel the world or hear the world, In order to be able to recognize and process information from the world, you first need to do a bit of learning about what the statistical objects are out there in the world. That is, for vision, there are things like contiguous lines, there are shapes that co-occur, there are different spatial and temporal frequencies, patterns that co-occur. And it turns out that your brain is learning these patterns all the time, shaping the way that circuits in your brain process that kind of sensory information so that you can then adequately encode, recognize, understand those objects later. A great example is language. When human infants are born, they can't recognize the differences between the different phonemes, speech sounds of their native language. They actually need to train themselves up, which they do extremely early in the first few months to years of life, listening to the sounds of their native language and forming in their brains a representation of what are the different sounds, A, E, A, O, U, etc., in their language. That process of learning is a process of neuroplasticity. Now, that's in a human, but you can ask very analogous questions in rodents, for example. You can have animals learn to sense the world through different, with different statistics in the world. And we study this in the somatosensory system, which is the system for touch. In the touch system, you also are learning statistics of objects in the world around you. But rodents do it not with their fingertips, but primarily with their whiskers, which are long hairs that they move around actively in space to sample objects. Well, if you change the statistics of an animal's tactile world, which you can do very simply by trimming off a few of its whiskers so that it feels the world through a slightly different or reduced whisker array, then it actually undergoes a perceptual learning process to reinterpret what the world feels like with that reduced whisker set. Now, in the brain of that animal, you can then study what are the actual cellular changes that take place that allow that learning to happen. And those cellular changes appear to be, from the information we have so far, very similar, if not identical, to the cellular changes that take place in higher mammals, including learning, for these sensory perceptual forms of learning. So by focusing on a basic form of learning that involves sensory processing, we can learn a tremendous amount about how the brain actually accomplishes learning.
Now, we shot some of this. When we did the original application for the National Science Foundation funding for this Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center adventure, we actually shot some of the work with you working with rats, if you recall. So this is not unlike using any kind of tactile device to feel your way through your social space and your universe.
Well, an interesting question is what the world feels like through whiskers. And humans don't have whiskers. No, those don't count because they're not movable through space. You don't really use them in the same way. So it's an interesting question from first principles of neurobiology. How do you analyze a sensory system that we don't have? And there are standardized methods for approaching that, and we use a lot of those methods in the lab. For example, you can ask, rodents can detect many different features of the world with their whiskers. They can detect the position of objects, the distance to an object, the shape of an object. They can detect the texture of objects, roughness. How do they do that? What is it about an object that is translated into the micro motions of a whisker across it as they drag their whiskers across objects that conveys texture to the animal? So you can measure behaviorally how rats perform these types of sensory discrimination, like texture discrimination. You can look at the circuits and brain areas that are involved in that. You can study at the very precise level how those texture inputs are encoded by the electrical activity, the spiking of neurons in the brain. And we've done many of these experiments. And one thing we've learned here is that the brain has interesting temporal constraints on how it views the world and learns the world. In terms of how it views the world, or in our case for the whiskers, feels the world, neurons in the brain act as if they have short little time windows of viewing the world, about 10 millisecond slices in time. And in those 10 millisecond slices, they represent in their electrical activity and their spiking patterns whether or not there is an object that they care about out there in the world. As time rolls by, the brain is taking successive 10 millisecond photographs or slices in time of that world, and it's by integration of that information that there seems to be an image of some sense produced in the cortex that conveys to the animal its changing world around it. This means that learning processes are also constrained in timescales. And one thing that we've learned in somatosensory cortex, which turns out to be a general property in many areas of the brain, is that neurons also seem to learn on the 10 or tens of milliseconds timescale. And this is the phenomenon known as spike timing dependent plasticity.
All right, so there are a couple of terms here I wanted you to unpack. One of them is spike timing dependent plasticity. The other one that you work on, according to the website here, is experience dependent map plasticity. So I assume that they are connected.
They are connected. So one way you can monitor learning in the brain is by looking at how learning of these statistical patterns in the environment changes how features of the world are represented in the brain. So a very basic feature of sensory systems in the brain is that there are orderly maps. In the visual world, for example, different cells in your retina in the back of your eye see different locations in the visual world. Those cells send axons that project indirectly, but ultimately, to different neurons within your visual cortex in a very systematic, ordered way, so that there's actually a retinotopic map or an eye-related map of position in the world on your brain. And that's true for the somatosensory system. Position on your body is mapped on the brain. It's true for the auditory system. Frequency is mapped in the brain, etc. So when an animal is challenged with a different set of statistics in the world, it turns out the topography of those maps changes. If I have 30 whiskers on my face and I use them all equally to feel the world, well, my map of whiskers in the cortex is divided into about 30 roughly equal chunks processing information from all those whiskers. But if I trim off 5 of my whiskers so that now I have 25 remaining and 5 deprived, and I spend a week running around sensing the world through my reduced whisker array, now my cortex changes. And the area that represents those whiskers, which are no longer very useful for my behavior, shrinks and weakens within the map. And the representations of the other whiskers expand within the map to take up that space, so that the map is dynamically changing all the time to reflect the statistics of the environment that are important for the animal. The same thing happens in every sensory map that we know of, and we think that this map plasticity is one of the basic phenomena that is mediating learning of basic sensory features in the brain.
All right, so let's talk about plasticity, since this is not, does not mean the brain consists of gooey stuff. It means it is capable of changing with new information, with new stimulus and so on. And that does not, as we've discovered over the last few decades, this is not something that's an all or nothing thing. It's not use it or lose it. You can, in fact, keep on
absolutely
having plasticity remains even in an adult brain. Could you gloss that a little bit more?
Sure. So it used to be thought 15 or 20 years ago that there were periods early in life where the brain was especially or uniquely plastic. These are called critical periods. And actually, for many types of learning, there are robust critical periods. Language learning is one of them. It's much easier to learn certain aspects of language comprehension and production early in life than it is later in life. But it was thought that these critical periods really govern many, many forms of learning in the brain. We now know that, in fact, the brain remains plastic into adulthood in basically every sensory modality and for many different forms of learning, so that young brains are more plastic, but adult brains certainly are plastic. Now, this might be something that the average person on the street knew well before neurobiologists, you know, could admit it to themselves, because we all know that we learn throughout life. The brain is learning for us, therefore the brain must remain plastic. And in fact, it does. One of the main areas of interest in neurobiology these days is to understand, are the learning mechanisms that are present in adult animals the same as those that were present in juveniles? Is there only a subset of mechanisms available? Why is it that plasticity, though it still remains robust, is not quite as strong as it was early in life?
But the connection there to real life, to classrooms and so on, is there quite evident? If you have a model of the brain, for example, which says that it's you can do anything you want to it, cram new information in it until about 13, then it's all downhill from there. That's a very different model of the brain from one that says, no, you keep on learning, it'll keep on learning, you can keep on feeding it information and so on. So
absolutely. So it's very...
You have different strategies that emerge from that.
It does make important suggestions. I guess it makes the important point that learning can still happen quite robustly in older animals and older people. But one might have to take a slightly different approach to get effective learning. So for example, one of the systems in which neurobiologists used to believe that learning happened uniquely in young animals and not at all in older animals is in a form of auditory learning, actually several different forms of auditory learning, but one is actually in songbirds. Songbirds learn their songs when they're young, and then at some point in life, most songbirds freeze their learning, and then they produce that one song repetitively throughout their life.
One-hit wonders.
Exactly. But it turns out that the adult bird brain remains absolutely plastic. That is, it can still learn. But you can only reveal that learning using different types of manipulations. And in a number of different systems, it's been shown that if you encourage animals to learn gradually, with repetition spaced over time to encourage gradual long-term learning, then you can get robust learning in adult animals in many different modalities where it was thought to not occur. So I would say to teachers, keep on teaching. You know, those brains are plastic, and absolutely things are learnable. They might be able to take a little longer to learn in after critical periods close.
If you had to explain to somebody, there's a whiteboard behind you, so let me just ask you to do plasticity learning, synapses 101. If you had to explain to a school class or something what is actually going on when we're talking about this sort of transmission of information, I mean, how would you do it fairly quickly? Could you show me something?
Sure, absolutely. Okay, here's a little neurobiology 101. So the brain is composed of cells called neurons. Neurons have input, they have regions that receive input called dendrites, and then they have a specialized process called an axon that makes a connection to the next neuron in the brain. And these synapses are where the action is for learning. Of all the synapses in the brain, learning wants to strengthen some synapses and not others, and it's the pattern of strengthened synapses that store information within the brain. So how is a synapse actually strengthened? Well, neurons produce electrical signals, and the main electrical signal they produce is a very brief signal that lasts just 1 millisecond in time, called an action potential, or a spike. So this cell will generate an action potential, a change in voltage over time. This moves down the axon to the presynaptic terminal region. And when it invades this region, it causes neurotransmitter, which is a chemical, which is normally stored inside little lipid vesicles in the presynaptic terminal, to be released. This chemical diffuses across the tiny space of the synapse, where it binds to specialized proteins in the postsynaptic cell, which are called receptors. And these receptors bind the neurotransmitter, and they're actually pores in the membrane that open up. So when the neurotransmitter binds, they open up, and electric current flows into the cell, which creates now an electrical potential in this neuron, which can make this neuron spike and send the signal to its partner. So that's normal synaptic function. The way that synaptic function changes is if a presynaptic spike helps to consistently drive postsynaptic spiking, you have a pattern of activity where the presynaptic neuron fires its spike before the postsynaptic neuron. And when this occurs within a critical time window of about 10 milliseconds, then this leads to biochemical changes at the synapse, which both increase the number of these receptors and can also increase the function, or sometimes the number, of presynaptic terminals, so that in the future, this synapse is now stronger than it was before. That is, the next time this cell is active, its spike will cause a lot more transmitter release, which will produce a bigger signal in the postsynaptic cell and produce more spikes here. So use of a synapse in a particular pattern can produce a long-lasting change, in this case an increase, in the strength of the synapse. And it's the pattern of these changes at synapses that stores information in neural circuits.
And that's plasticity, that's thoughts, and that's feelings.
Those patterns of spikes in your brain are all those things. They're thoughts, they're feelings, they're memories. And so the ability of one cell to evoke the appropriate pattern of activity in downstream cells is presumably what helps recall a memory that you've stored, for example.
Great, thanks. Let's go on with the conversation then. And one of the reasons for asking about that, of course, is that with the spread of information, I mean, I could go to, and did, as anybody could, go to Wikipedia, and put in spike timing dependent plasticity. And there's an article here, which I don't know if you wrote it or not.
No, I did not.
But here it is, you know, a general term for functional changes in neurons and its synapses that are sensitive to the timing of action potentials in connected neurons, what we've just been talking about. And it actually mentions here work by Bruce McNaughton, Yang Dan, Muming Pu, who I'll be talking to later today. So this is obviously a very key topic in this whole issue. Now, you're a member, as a member of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, which has a network of networks organization. So there's an interacting memory systems network, you know all this, perceptual expertise network. We were at Vanderbilt a few weeks ago with Isabel Gauthier, Tom Palmieri, and so on. There's a social interaction network, and you're part of the sensory motor network. Other people there, I noticed Howard Poisner and so on, Tony Bell. How do you interact? How does your work fit together with the rest of the networks and so on? How do you interact with these folks?
Well, I think the first question to ask is, why did we put sensory and motor people together within one research network to learn something about how the brain learns? And there the idea is that many forms of important learning for people have to do with learning to integrate sensory events and motor events. When you move through the world and explore the world, you make motions that bring you through the world, interact with the world, you learn things about the world. Sensation and motion are intimately intertwined. A great example of that is actually in the whisker system that we study, and the tactile system in general. In order to learn something about your tactile environment, you or the rat have to reach out and investigate it. You don't learn anything about the world sitting here like this. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand how motion is controlled, how that actually helps animals sample the environment, and that will tell us something important about how even basic sensory patterns are learned. So we've brought these sensory and motor people together, representing two fields of neuroscience that are traditionally kept quite separate, in order to try and make sparks fly on ideas for thinking on the next step of understanding learning in integrated sensory motor systems. Now, these other networks, the Interacting Memory Systems Network, Perceptual Expertise Network, etc., there are members of our sensory motor network who have lots of different interests, and many of our interests overlap with those in other networks. And so these networks are sort of like wagon wheels, where the spokes of the wagon wheels could go out and hit the next network over here. And so there's mm-hmm. a bunch of different intersections that bring us all together. So that's how the organization works.
So, and it makes the point that something that I find in, as I go around from location to location, as I said, we just came from ASU, where the president of ASU, Michael Crow, is essentially taking a wrecking ball to some of the original silos concept of different departments and so on, as integrating things around transdisciplinary centers. I don't think there's anybody suggesting that expertise in specific areas should be done away with, but plainly, if you're talking at systems, about systems, then there has to be some connection, connectivity, and conversation between the various investigators of those different parts of the system.
Well, absolutely, and in fact, in a way, the study of learning benefits from this strongly, because the two of the disciplines that study this quite strongly, which are neurobiology and cognitive science, mm-hmm. these are recent disciplines which grew up in a very interdisciplinary way. So neuroscience pulls on people who, you know, work on the genetic level, the cellular level, molecular level, systems level, behavioral levels, and theoretical modeling levels. Cognitive science, likewise, has people working on very abstract psychological levels, a lot of computation, a lot of thinking about how real neural networks work. They're both incredibly interdisciplinary efforts, and I think the TDLC organized itself kind of organically in that same spirit. And we hope that this will help break down these borders and identify new areas of productive research that can really help understand how learning works.
Yeah. How do you explain to people what you do if you're at a parent-teachers association meeting or something and they ask you that question?
I say that your brain is doing a tremendous amount of work for you in negotiating the world and learning the world. And if we want to understand how people learn, how people experience the world, how we interact even with each other, we need to know how that machine in our heads is doing that. And I see the brain as a machine made out of salt and fat and protein that is making computations that make your view of the world and your memory of the world possible.
And then they look at you and say, well, but what about meaning? And no? Do you get any philosophical queries at that point?
Well, I'm not saying that other levels of looking at the world aren't true. I'm just saying that from a mechanistic point of view of how does the world work, studying the brain is the right focus for answering that question.
What I was getting at was that do you actually wrestle with those sorts of issues in your quiet time?
No, I think we understand extraordinarily little about how the brain really works. I am a firm believer that ultimately, in the processes of the brain, there will be mechanistic explanations for basically all psychological phenomena, for feelings, etc. But there are huge areas of neuroscience that we don't know, and the interface between how brain cells work and how they generate this internal mental life that we all have, that is a huge black hole in neuroscience. I trust that the brain does that for me. It helps make all of our lives enjoyable and rich. We're studying the basic nuts and bolts of how the brain works.
So is this an exciting time to be in neuroscience?
This is a fascinating time to be in neuroscience. So let me give you one example for that. Well, a lot of our work focuses on the cerebral cortex, this tremendous sheet of cells on the outside of the brain that is involved in basic sensory and motor processing, but also a lot of high-level cognitive phenomena, including learning. We now know, after 30 years of very hard work and rapidly evolving techniques, we know so much about how some areas of the cortex are wired together, what cell types they have, how those synapses work, what kinds of rhythms they generate, how they process information, that for the first time you can see on the horizon growing a conceptual understanding of how the brain does its job. Mm-hmm. To make the sensory world perceivable and also to learn things about the sensory world. And so this is a tremendously exciting integrative time in neuroscience.
All right, so the importance of science. Let me just, a little segue there. One of the questions I've been asking a lot of people is that when he came into office on his inaugural address on January the 20th, 2009, President Obama said that we will restore science to its rightful place. What is the rightful place of science, do you think?
Well, I think if science fulfills its promise, it could reveal fundamental basic knowledge about how humans and other animals work and live and why we are the way we are in a physical sense. And in addition, it can provide important explanations for why things go wrong in biological processes. And in neurobiology, of course, there are unfortunately many neurological and psychiatric disorders that have no treatment. We need to understand a lot more about how the brain works in order to be able to help that. Now, regarding learning, there are many, there's a wide variation across people in ability to learn different types of subjects. We as scientists are learning how the brain learns, and our hope is that the more we understand that, the more we can understand new strategies, new approaches that will help optimize or maximize learning for the benefit of everybody in society. Now, science is in a tough place. Funding for research in the United States, in terms of how hard scientists need to compete in order to get those precious research dollars, is the most difficult it's ever been in the post-war era. And people are unfortunately even beginning to drop out of science in many places. But I think, and I know there are many demands in society for funding different important efforts. I'm hoping that America can keep funding its scientific research efforts in a way that can keep pushing forward progress on many, many fronts.
Okay. Now, everybody has a sort of a narrative, a story, how they got to be, why you're sitting in this chair right now. How did you go into science? What was the story there? Were there any, do you remember anything? Was it parents, teachers, a book?
I've just been fascinated with learning my whole life. And I've wanted to know how it is that the brain, which seems to be made of fragile elements, can remember something for your entire life, and how that information can help us individually and with people. And I think, you know, in the time that I've been in neuroscience, which I look back and think is now about 20 years maybe, there has been tremendous progress in understanding how that works. It's been a very exciting time.
So did you read Proust on the...
I have read at least part of Proust. Now, I'm not
sure...
The
same part that everybody else has read, presumably, which leads you to think about the Madeleines and where memory is.
Exactly.
So
actually, you know, in that famous chapter of Proust, the type of memory that's really being highlighted is something we call associative memory. Remember one thing that brings up a memory of something else, and a third thing and a fourth thing, which you link together either in time or thematically in your memory. There have been psychological theories for how that works for 50 years, 60 years. But we've gotten finally a neurobiological understanding of how that actually works in a very satisfying mechanistic way in the past 10 or 15 years. And this has really opened new vistas to understanding learning, improving learning deficits or disabilities, and dealing with what can be maladaptive forms of learning. People don't often think about this this way, but addiction is actually a maladaptive form of learning. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a maladaptive form of emotional or anxiety learning. And so the more we know about how these forms of learning take place, the more we can design effective either teaching strategies or therapies to help improve the lives of people with these disorders.
All right, now, so let's just follow this up a little bit. The notion of memory being autobiographical memory, particularly you're thinking about at this point, this strange contra distinction between as you go through life, as the rat goes through life with its, you know, feeling its way and so on, that this is an online, real-time, brain-changing experience, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, we, who do the same sort of thing, imagine that we have this autobiographical description of ourselves through time, which we possibly incorrectly think of as being a constant, right? So how is this constant change and this sense of being a coherent self through time, how do you reconcile those two?
That is a very philosophical question. I think when you measure how the brain changes to store memories, there are changes at synapses that occur. Synapses are the connections between neurons. And we understand a fair bit about how changes at those synaptic connections can actually store information in the brain. So I think it's very clear that as animals and animal models of autobiographical learning, of associational learning, as they learn those events, it's very clear that there are these changes at synapses that are occurring, and this is helping to store information. Now, 5 years down the road, when you look back and say, what was I doing 5 years ago, and you construct a narrative within your head of that series of events, some of that narrative probably is veridically true and reflects the information that was stored. Some of it may actually recall the act of recalling that information in the meantime. And so I think one's version of autobiographical memory changes over time as you retell those stories. You know, humans are storytellers. The act of retelling the story reconsolidates that memory in the brain, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly, but that's what you remember after some period of time. So I think it is a mystery still on the biological level how you span from a detailed understanding of how individual memories are stored, which we have, to how does one recall the lifetime of memory which seems so inextricably linked, and there we really don't know how that process is done yet.
And when you say stored, I mean, what are we talking about? You know, obviously you have to get away from the filing cabinet sort of analogy.
Well,
but I mean, Terry Sanofsky, for example, would say, well, perhaps this is all in the extracellular matrix because that's more of a constant.
I think the strongest evidence is that it's stored in what's called the strength of synaptic connections. You have billions of neurons in your brain. They connect to each other in a very sparse but specific way. Which neurons connect to which other neurons by effective, strong synapses is thought to be the meat of information storage in most areas of the brain. That pattern of synaptic connections can be adjusted by changing how well a given cell can release neurotransmitter, which excites the next cell across the synapse, or how the postsynaptic cell in the synapse, how strongly it reacts to that neurotransmitter that's being secreted by its presynaptic partner. So changes in the protein levels, and protein is different proteins that are what governs transmitter release and reception of the transmitter. Changes in those levels of proteins can produce long-lasting change in the strength of the synapse. Ultimately, it's genes. We have a false dichotomy, I think, sometimes in imagining that human behavior or animal behavior is nature versus nurture, and that somehow nature is what is governed by your genes and nurture is what you learn through life. But actually, we know very clearly, and we have for quite some time, that one's experience and learning alters the expression of genes in different cells. And by changing how those cells stably express different genes, you can produce very long-term changes in the function of synapses and therefore information storage in the brain.
And this is now, at least in the public arena, to the extent that you actually see cover stories of time on epigenetics, which is what you've just been talking about.
This is epigenetics, absolutely.
Yeah. The philosopher Owen Flanagan, just to go back to the memory thing, and I'm going to get I don't have the exact details, I don't recall them perfectly, but just to give you an example of what we were talking about, the philosopher Owen Flanagan, at one point in his early life as a kid, lived in Puerto Rico. Then they moved, I think, to the States. And I think his parents, somebody was saying to him, well, of course, it's a great advantage to, because at least you've got lots of friends here. You had no one to play with in Puerto Rico. And he said, well, there was Billy somebody or other, I can't remember. I used to play with him all the time. And he said his mother looked at him, looked at his father, and his father looked at him. And the mother said, his family visited for 3 days, and you played for him for one afternoon? And he had this entire complex sense of having this person as a playmate over a long term, based on the experience of that one afternoon. It's a very interesting thing that we do with experiences, isn't it?
It's remarkable. It's remarkable how efficiently individual experiences can be stored, but then sometimes even buried for a long time until some association brings it up later, and like the smell of tea, you remember the Madeleines.
Yeah. Do you think your rats are ever troubled, and as you work with them, they think, how well do you think rodents remember things? And what level do you think they remember things?
Well, you
not
know,
not cartoon rodents, either.
Yeah, the type of memory we study is sort of a slow learning of the statistics of the world. That's not something that happens once and then you remember it for your lifetime.
Right.
Instead, these maps in the brain are changing over the time scale of a few weeks, remembering the statistics that occurred in the last few weeks. It really is true, by the way, that when a student goes to school and learns new things, and those new items are written into the synapses of the brain, it literally is true that the child leaves school with a different brain than the child walked in with. And so the same thing is true, I think, for learning in rats. So the type of learning that we study is more a slow statistical process. However, there are other groups, and in fact some of the members of TDLC, like Andrea Chiba and like Yuri Buzhaki and others, study forms of learning in which animals are acquainted with stimuli, typically a little environment that they have to learn about. And they may be in that environment for a few days and they learn about that environment. They develop a neural representation in their brain of information about that environment. And then they can retain that information for months and months of time. In fact, there have been beautiful studies done by others showing that an animal, the neurons in the hippocampus of an animal can remember an arena that a rat was put in for a few days for almost a year of time. So in some sense, the animals can have a long-term memory. Of course, that's different necessarily from a cognitive memory that humans might have.
So what would you regard as being a sign of success, of your own personal well-being, a life well spent? What kind of results are you looking for that make you feel, that was worthwhile?
I think if we could understand how the brain or the cerebral cortex builds up our sensory perceptual world, why it is that you look the way you do, that the room smells the way it smells, that my chair feels the way it feels, then I think we'll have understood a tremendous amount about what the brain does. Learning how things feel naturally involves learning. It involves understanding the patterns in your environment. And so part of understanding the sensory perception process is understanding these basic forms of learning that humans also use when they're young.
As you think, is there anything, do you think you'd ever considered any other kind of career, or was it always to be a scientist for you?
Well,
anything else you wanted to be?
I love...
Rock star?
No, not, definitely not a rock star. I love novels, and for a long time I thought about becoming a writer. As it is, as a scientist, you can do a lot of writing. It just is much more boring writing than you can do as creative writing.
So the creative act in terms of the use, when we were talking about Proust, the whole notion of how to describe these processes in a literary sense and in a pragmatic scientific sense, sort of bring those together.
Well, science is very creative. We have, you know, especially for neuroscience, the brain is tremendously complicated, and coming up with clever ways of understanding how it works, predictions about how brain function might put constraints on animal learning or human learning, what those mean for learning, that is a very creative process. So it's very satisfying to do research and make progress on these tough questions and use creative approaches to do that.
I tend to ask people this dinner party question, which is that you can have a time capsule, you can time travel, you can do whatever you want. Anybody you'd really like to sit down and have a conversation with at dinner, somebody you'd like to pump them, get some thoughts from them?
No one's asked me that at a dinner party in a very long time.
You've got to start going to better dinner parties.
Yeah.
Nobody said, didn't you want to talk to William James about this? Or
you know who I would like to talk to? It's not William James.
Okay.
But I would like to talk to Rene Descartes. Descartes lived at a fascinating time in intellectual history and in science. As the medieval period was emerging into modern thought, he developed mechanistic views of how the body worked and of how mental phenomena worked, like vision, for example. Now, those views were not based on what we know of nowadays as the brain or neurons, but still, he imagined that bodies are physical entities that essentially process information. And this, I think, is the dominant viewpoint among scientists now, and I think has led to tremendous developments in the last 200 years. And that must have been a very interesting time to be on the cusp of that transition.
Yeah. If you have students coming through your labs, obviously, right? So one of the things that I like to ask seasoned investigators, referring back to the book of Peter Medawar's Advice to a Young Scientist, which is also Ramon y Cajal had a Advice to a Young Investigator. What would be your advice to a young starting scientist at this point?
My advice would be to let your curiosity be your guide. Science has made tremendous progress, but we know still relatively little about how biological function, brain function, and cellular function works. And sometimes the simple intuitive questions will bring you to a new line of investigation and to whole new regions of how physical systems work. So I'd say follow your creative intuition.
Okay, one last thing. What are you optimistic about?
I'm not that optimistic a person, Roger.
You're doing science.
I'm hopeful. I guess I would say I'm optimistic that all this information that neurobiology has been able to uncover in the past few decades about the brain will begin to come together to give us a really fundamental and more abstract idea of what the brain does, what goes wrong when it's not working correctly, and how to fix it.
And then that, we hope, could be translated into practical issues like we began this
absolutely
this conversation with. So yeah, thanks very much, Dan Feldman.
Thank you.